CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, historian Victor Davis Hanson, a classicist historian, but also writing The Second World War, Some Years Past, a book where Victor very carefully took us through the revisionism of the Second World War and whatever happened to the results of the war, the adversaries, the allies, their emissions and their ambitions. We go to one particular adversary who here in the 21st century is regarded as the great ally of the United States. I'm talking about the Japan, then the Imperial Japanese Empire. Victor, what is instructive here is how similar some of the big talk in Tokyo in 1931 resembles the big talk in Beijing in 2021. So there we have it, 80 years coming to the same theme. What was the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, and how did it work? Good evening to you, Victor.
Good evening. It was dreamed up in 1938-39 and then put into ad hoc process and then formally declared late 41. And what it was is Japan said that all of these Asian countries on its perimeter and in the Pacific had suffered from European colonialism, and they would integrate their economies and their natural resources to feed the Japanese industrial titan, and then in exchange, Japan would create a peaceful sphere of Asian co-prosperity. And it was predicated realistically on the fact that after Hitler had overrun Western Europe, Japan looked around its perimeter and said, you know what, there is no more Holland. The Netherlands ceases to exist, so the Dutch East Indies and the Shell oil fields should be ours. And then they looked at Southeast Asia in 1940 and they said, you know what, France ceased to exist in late June of 1940, so all of that breadbasket in Cambodia and Vietnam, et cetera, is ripe for the taking. And then they said, Britain is isolated, and Malaysia with its rubber and its oil and Singapore will be easy to pluck. And then they made the catastrophic further correlation that the United States, while not a colonial power, was isolationist, and then they could pick off the Philippines from it as well. But it was a predatory idea, but it was dressed up in utopian rhetoric and benevolence.
Did it have some purchase? Did people of the Southeast Asia in the Indonesian archipelago, or in the Philippines, did they listen to the propaganda?
I think in the beginning they did, especially in India. There were people like Bose, the Indian so-called nationalists, that felt they could deal with the Japanese or maybe the Axis powers in general. In other words, they were going to liberate them, and even though they were fascistic, maybe it would be give them some opportunity. But I think by 1942, they saw that the Japanese were far worse taskmasters than any European colonialist. And finally, by 44, all of those occupied areas were actively welcoming American and British liberation.
In 1931, the Japanese Empire invaded what is now China, especially the Manchurian provinces, that became an industrial base called the Manchukuo. That went on from 31 all the way through the 1930s and was not ignored, but certainly wasn't front page news. That particular aggression, did that impress or intimidate the United States? This is the Hoover administration and then the early days of the New Deal under FDR.
We always had a soft spot for China, because there were a number of Chinese intellectuals that had migrated to the United States, and there had been large Chinese expatriate population since the railroad boom of the late 19th century. And then there was anger at the aggression of Japan, not only in South Korea or what we would call Korea at that time, but also in China. But we didn't know much about it. We felt that maybe these were just bullies. We didn't know quite what their grand imperial policy was. We'd had the Panay that was attacked. Americans had been treated badly in China on occasion by Japanese occupiers. But we thought this was a matter for the League of Nations or maybe the British imperial powers, Western European. We were just going to stay out of it during the Depression. That changed in 1939 when the Japanese had this huge border war along the Mongolian border with the Russians. And then people were were taken back. I should say just in passing, John, that in the Japanese mentality, that army that occupied parts of China and then later tried to fight with the Soviets was not up to Soviet standards. It was very effective against ill-prepared Chinese troops, but Japan's westernization had already been very effective in terms of air power and nautical power. They were the match of European powers in the Pacific, but they were not capable in terms of artillery or machine guns or track vehicles or armor to conduct a land war, and they learned that to their surprise, but also their great damage in August of 1939.
But you report the Imperial Japanese Navy was a match for the U.S. 7th Fleet, and in fact, the Kido Butai, the six carriers that eventually attacked Pearl Harbor, were the match for anything that we were putting out at the time. So was Washington alarmed by the evidence of the Japanese building an aggressive navy?
They were, because they felt that they had obligations not only in the Pacific, but also in the Atlantic. So they had two fleets. Combined, they were bigger. They were the second largest fleet in the world after Britain in 1939. But when you divided them between East and West, they were not. And they tended to focus a little bit more on carriers in the Pacific because of the great distances and battleships and cruisers in the Atlantic. But when they looked carrier per carrier, I mean, we had been arming very quickly in the late 1930s. We had these sort of Rush, Enterprise, Yorktown, Hornet, and Wasp, smaller carriers, not the big Lexington and Saratoga of the 1920s that were battle cruiser hulls. But by the time the war started, what the Japanese failed to realize is that the existing American fleet, remember, John, by you can make the argument pretty clearly by late 1942, only the Enterprise was active and it was wounded. They had sunk Wasp, Hornet, Yorktown, Lexington, damaged Saratoga. But what they didn't realize, there were 27 Essex carriers, all, each one of them better than any carrier in the world that were already not only in the pipeline, but already emerging and starting to appear by late 1942.
You're anticipating where I'm going, Victor, because now we're going to come to the 21st century. 80 years later, Japanese invaded Manchukuo in 1931, and that began a bloody campaign that led to the Japanese declaring the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, which was propaganda to explain their aggression against ill-matched forces, local forces, the colonial powers, did not match the Japanese deployment in the late 1930s, early 1940s. In the 21st century, we're told much of the capabilities and of the aggression and of the scale of the People's Republic of China's People's Liberation Army and Navy and Air Force. You publish an essay in American Greatness that says that we're misled by the Chinese aggression in much the same way we were misled by the Japanese aggression. How so, Victor?
Well, I think that we haven't been as vigorous or muscular in expanding our military. It's down to almost, as far as GDP, a very low, not since Vietnam, that area after the Vietnam Wars have been so low. It's down to 3% or lower, getting there. And the Chinese are expanding. But we forget that we're a global power, a blue water neighbor. China cannot send a fleet into the Caribbean as we can off the coast of Japan or South Korea. So we have a lot more responsibilities than they do. And if you look in terms of what makes a military function, it's economics. And still, by most metrics, the U.S. economy is about 40 to 45% bigger than China. And that's an astounding fact, John, because it's 330 million Americans are producing the goods and services, much more than 1.5 billion Chinese. So if you look at education or food or oil and gas production, rankings of universities, Nobel Prize winners, who got vaccinations out, things like that, were way, way ahead of the Chinese. The problem is that they have a larger continent. They have a population that's almost five times larger, and they're westernizing in the elements that can contribute to military power. And they have a united population that is bent on, as the Japanese were, on dominating the United States. And so we're kind of like 1939, 40, we say we're woke, but we're woke culturally, but militarily or in terms of foreign policy, we're somnolent, we're unwoke.
I'm speaking with Victor Davis Hanson, the historian Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution. The book that we're referencing is Victor's The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. In the theory that there may be ongoing and maybe soon a second global conflict, what is to be done when we come back? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.